Chapter 36. It had been 3 weeks since arrival on Amir, and nearly that long since the encounter with Rupak. That had been the last time the enemy was seen. Which wasn't to say that things hadn't been eventful. Progress on Camp Ohio moved unceasingly, the only full stop coming when Captain Bosa led a memorial service for those lost in transit aboard the Boone. Ohio was still a long way from being able to absorb the Osei population, but it was much more defensible now, with a defined perimeter protected by wire and studded with combat outposts that allowed the Rangers to maintain fire superiority while still freeing up bodies for patrols. And it was a patrol that had Lieutenant Harmon amped up. His commission had just come before the burial ceremony, and this was the first time he'd be moving out with 2nd Platoon. It was a routine patrol, but to him it would be a meaningful one. He'd been the first in his family to join the army, and he'd taken some serious flak for it. That wasn't what a Harmon was meant to do. But he took it all in stride, correcting or ignoring the misperceptions about what he did as a Ranger, and shrugging off the severing of ties by some overzealous aunts and cousins. He grew used to getting ignored at family barbecues, became accustomed to the whispers behind his back, patiently listened as the family shifted him to the role of defender-in-chief of anything and everything wrong with the military and with America itself. By the time the war started, Harmon had spent so many tours overseas that his family was an afterthought. They didn't write, and neither did he. Leaving for the Amir mission hadn't been a difficult choice. The Boone carried with it all the family he'd ever need.
"We ready to move, LT?" called Sergeant Stanga from the rear of a Badger.
2nd Platoon would ride in 2 Badgers for a patrol that would encompass a path that went 5 clicks out, culminating in a sweep of the western sector of forest.
"Not yet. Captain wants us to take one of the AIs with us for some extra firepower."
"Is it Alexa?"
asked PFC Marks.
"I wouldn't mind seeing her again."
"Yeah, been a while since I saw her," chimed in another Ranger. "Those Osei women are nice and all, but she's a machine," said Harmon, smiling at the laughs. "And no, we got Brody."
"He's all right," said Stanga. "Doc Roman's got most of the quirks ironed out. He doesn't threaten to shoot us for being spies anymore."
Today would be Harmon's first interaction with the walking, talking combat suit, but he'd already heard plenty about Brody. The AI's reputation preceded him.
"Hey, LT."
Harmon turned to see SBC Turner running toward them in full kit.
"Can I catch a ride, sir? Getting worried that hanging in that comms array is going to become my life if I don't leave."
Harmon smiled.
"No one needs you in there?"
"Ramirez has my back. I'm still a Ranger, sir. I'd like to get on patrol at least once."
"Hop in."
Brody arrived next, shouting a greeting to the Rangers assembled on the Badgers.
"All right, sweethearts, what are you waiting for? Breakfast in bed? Another glorious day for Brody."
Harmon moved to the big android side.
"Captain Bosa said he'd review the route of patrol with you prior to our arrival. Just want to make sure we're working on the same sheet of music."
Brody tapped the side of his head.
"I got a full symphony up here. Question is, why aren't your men ready?"
"I believe they're ready," Harmon said. "Sergeant Stanga, are your men ready?"
"Ready for anything but another safety brief, sir."
"Satisfied?" said Harmon.
He'd been told that it was easiest to just humor Brody and his odd personality. Work with it instead of against it.
"Well, if you're so ready, how come these men don't have tiger stripes painted on their faces? Look at those moon pies. Out there, yeah, Charlie'll see that clear as a traffic cone in a snowfield."
"If we see any Charlie out here on Amir," Stanga said, "we'll pull over to rub dirt on our faces. How's that, Brody?"
"Roger, citizen."
Brody snapped a salute to Lieutenant Harmon.
"Let's roll."
He clambered onto one of the Badgers, squishing his way between Rangers.
"You guys ever see Platoon? I am reality."
That was easy enough, thought Harmon.
He entered the front cab of the lead Badger and ordered the small convoy to move out. The path leading from Ohio had already been paved for the first half kilometer, mostly the work of the Osei men who'd come to help prepare the camp. Those same men were now working hard to clear the area around the road where the blacktop gave way to the wildland. M4s swung from their carry harnesses as they waved the passing badgers. The rangers waved back. Harmon was happy to see that there was no air of superiority from his men, nor had he heard anything about the Osei people being treated in derision, as he had feared was a possibility. The men understood that for them to have a firm and established future, they needed the Osei. As they wound through the patrol route, the lead badger's driver asked,
"You think we'll run into any Rupak, LT? Been a while." "I assume we will, and you'll never be surprised. But I take your point, Private Brown. If they're still out there, they're keeping their heads down."
They drove another half hour, spooking a small herd of the feathered horses, which the Osei called platyers.
"Let them go,"
ordered Harmon, much to the disappointment of his men. A few days earlier, some of the platyers had wandered close enough to Camp Ohio that the Osei took a couple down and butchered them for everyone to enjoy. They were delicious, like Bolivian steak marinated in mangoes. Now the men longed for one to be taken down whenever they encountered one. But that wasn't the purpose of this patrol, and while Rupak might already have eyes on their comings and goings, Harmon didn't want to announce his presence any more than he had to. The men looked out for some of the fierce multi-tongued predators and found none of those either, but the word from the Osei was that they tasted like boiled garbage. It was just before a sharp right turn, a spot in the road that would eventually be spaced out once improvements continued, that Harmon picked up potential hostiles from the badger's sensors.
"Got something?"
"More platyers?" asked Sergeant Stanga.
The answer came in the form of incoming small arms fire raking the armored plating of the badgers.
"Contact!"
shouted the rangers, who dismounted and moved to engage fire. Brody yelled the same, sounding quite happy about it. Harmon coolly assessed the situation. He sent relevant sensor readings to his team leaders to help coordinate fire and listen to their reports. Soon, the badgers' guns were booming, deforesting the section of forest from which the incoming fire came. Branches and tree limbs fell, and bushes outright evaporated under the hot barrage of badger fire. But the pace of the incoming fire didn't slacken. The lieutenant examined the badgers' external camera views.
"Stanga, I'm not seeing what's going on. We should be hammering them."
"Roger, LT, there's a ditch on the other side of the road. You're shooting over their heads."
"Copy. I'll try to adjust fire."
"Still too high," Stanga said after a moment. "We'll get some grenades on top of them and..." "Wait one. Brody is moving across the road."
"Talk to me, Brody," Harmon ordered.
"Just keep shooting at them, Tex. I'm performing a flanking maneuver. It's a war college thing."
Harmon wanted to tell the AI that he knew what a flanking maneuver was, but the natural ranger tendency to keep communication short, combined with Lieutenant Sherman's personal emphasis to keep the comms extra clear, had him holding his tongue. And all for the better. His cockpit came alive with a new beeping. "What's that?" the driver asked, slowly rocked in his seat by the badger's steady fire.
"Something electronic in the AO," Harmon muttered.
He searched the readings. It was distant, but right above them.
"We've got a drone flying overhead. Badger 2, break contact on the road and try to bring that thing down." "Roger."
The intensity of fire dipped as Badger 2 reoriented its weapons in hopes of splashing the drone. Meanwhile, Harmon observed Brody moving across the road and executing a crossfire directed at the ambushers.
"No!" Brody screamed. "Come on!"
"Brody, what's happening?" Harmon asked.
"They're freaking surrendering. Permission to terminate. They're standing still. Well-trained, VC."
"Denied. Keep an eye on them. Are there more still engaged?"
"Negative. This is it. I did kill 8 Rupak, so I got that going for me, which is nice."
"Cease fire," Harmon ordered. "Stanga, Ace report."
"All squads are good."
"Roger. Send some men to help Brody secure the prisoners. Badger 2, what's the status on that drone?"
"Bugged out, sir. I don't think we got it."
"All right. Keep eyes open in case it comes back around."
Harmon called into Ohio as he watched Turner and a few other rangers hustle across the road. They reemerged with 2 prisoners, with very different appearances. The first man was one of the dirty, tired, and rail-thin Rupak men they'd grown accustomed to encountering on Amir. The second man was as strapping and healthy as any of the Rangers.
"We've got some company to bring back, Captain," Harmon said. "Looks like Rupak isn't sharing the food very well."
Reach stood in the newly printed interrogation room. It resembled every police questioning room he'd ever seen, Spartan but tidy, except instead of a two-way mirror, the techs had set up a closed-circuit camera, allowing Reach, Bosa, and Lieutenant Sherman to observe the interrogations from afar. The first of the two Rupak prisoners to be questioned was the healthier one. He looked as though he could belong to the same unit Reach had encountered with Dessen and Alexa. Other than being a bit too pale, the blonde, blue-eyed soldier was the picture of health. He was led to a chair and cuffed to the table by PFC Dunn, who, along with SBC Turner, was assigned to translate for the Rupak soldiers, provided those soldiers understood Russian or Chinese. Bosa then sent Lieutenant Sherman in to conduct the interview. Reach watched through the monitor as Sherman entered the room and took a seat opposite the prisoner.
"I'm Lieutenant Sherman, United States Army. What's your name?"
Dunn translated into Russian. The prisoner looked casually at the private, then back at Sherman. He had a dismissive, almost bored look about him. He wore no discernible rank, nor was any information found on him.
"It may surprise you to learn that the hostilities between the Russo-Chinese Pacific Alliance and the United States of America were resolved long before either of us arrived on Amir."
The prisoner remained impassive and didn't even look at Dunn as he translated. If he was surprised by this, he didn't show it. More likely, he didn't believe it.
"Our desire is not to make war against you or your fellow soldiers, but that can't happen so long as you remain the aggressor. What I want from you is to know the location of the Rupak camp. We want to talk. There's no reason why this planet can't be large enough for all of us."
The soldier yawned as Dunn issued the translation.
"He's not paying attention to Dunn at all," Reach observed. "I think this guy speaks English."
Captain Bosa arched an eyebrow and then pinged Sherman's implant.
"Sherm, ask him if he speaks English."
"Do you speak English?"
Sherman asked, holding up a hand to tell Dunn to refrain from translating.
"You do, don't you?"
The soldier gave a condescending grin.
"Still got nothing to say, huh? All right. Let's come back to the camp another time. Let's talk about racism." "Yes, racism. The way I heard it, Rupak was a glorious alliance of Russians and Chinese, plus a few other nationalities that got forced at gunpoint to sit in the back of your little deathmobile."
Reach and Bosa both leaned forward, curious to see where Sherman was going with this.
"So why is it that you blue-eyed Rupak are well-fed, and the Chinese and Iranian Rupak we run into look like they're starving to death? I know America was supposed to be the racist big Satan, but when I look at my Rangers, well, we're all eating."
The soldier smugly tilted his head as if to ask, "Are you done?" Reach felt this wasn't likely to go anywhere. The man wasn't going to talk. Motivation might be found later after time in confinement began to set in. He turned to Bosa.
"Why don't we send this one off to bed and see how the other one does?"
"Agreed. Sherm, let's have him spend a couple nights in the brig. Don't let anyone speak to him for 48 hours. We'll see if he's more talkative then."
Sherman gave the order, and Turner and Dunn took the man back to the recently printed cells of the new brig. When they returned with the second Rupak prisoner, the contrast was striking. This man, clearly of Chinese descent, was starvation thin. His face was dirty and gaunt, his eyes hollow. But his posture was not that of a beaten man, and he didn't display the smug superiority of the previous soldier. In fact, as Dunn and Turner walked him in and sat him down, he was already talking to them.
"I think this one wants to help," Reach observed.
"If so, he would be the first," said Bosa.
The man seemed not only willing but eager to talk. He answered only those questions that were asked of him, but Reach got the sense that he wanted to be asked questions, that he wanted to help the Americans. With Turner translating between English and Chinese, the prisoner told them his name was Xiaoping Gao, and that he had been pulled from a regular infantry unit to go on an emergency mission to follow the U.S. to Amir, a mission he did not want to undertake. When they arrived in orbit, coming out of cryo took longer than it should have. They were sick for a week. Two United States ships arrived during this time. Had the RUPAC crew not been vomiting whatever rations they could force down, they might have successfully brought down both ships with long-range missiles. As it was, they still managed to heavily damage one ship before taking damage themselves and being forced to undertake an emergency landing. Many died in the crash, though according to Gao, he didn't know that until later.
"Why not?" Sherman asked.
Turner translated the response.
"He says that the emergency landing protocols required that everyone get back into their cryopods. Those that didn't died. He says they woke up 7 years later and found the bodies throughout the wreckage."
Reach found that he was comprehending Gao directly before Turner had time to translate, and as such, he knew that what Turner had relayed was an abbreviated account. Gao's actual story was much more gruesome. Men woke up 7 years later, the maximum time around the cryopods, only to find that their sickness remained. Many were forced to lie in their pods, the desiccated bodies of their comrades lying mere feet away, decomposed to mummified flesh and bone. It was a dark time. When at last they recovered, they buried their dead. The officers insisted they patrol to see if more RUPAC had arrived. They did not find RUPAC, but they did find the crash site of one of the American ships, and...
"He says they were defeated by a demon," Turner translated.
"That's probably Brody," Bosa said.
"Sherm, ask him if the demon was there again when they were captured."
"Yes," Turner translated.
"He says that's why they surrendered. The demon had killed many of his friends. He was afraid."
"This guy," Reach said, shaking his head. "I'll bet you a trip back home that he was plucked from deep in the Chinese country to join the military."
"That'll have to be a story for another time," said Bosa. "We need to know something more than his history."
Sherman asked what happened after they were repulsed at Camp Muir. Turner translated.
"They went back into cryo, feeling that there was no hope on Amir. 7 years later, they woke up again, sent scouts, and found the situation was no better. They didn't wake up again for another 10 years.
"Why 10?
"He says that a few of the pods failed, and the men who came out of it, rather than waking the others, lived off of the rations, tinkering with the pods to keep everyone else asleep longer. By 3 years, though, they were at the point of starvation, so they woke the others."
Reach and Bosa exchanged a look. RUPAC's experience on Amir had been substantially worse than what the Boone and even the Muir survivors had faced.
"Those men were executed for stealing rations," Turner continued. "Once that was done, everyone else went back into cryo, hoping that someday more RUPAC would arrive and wake them at that time."
"Is that who the other man we captured you with was?" Sherman asked. "New RUPAC arrivals?"
Turner translated. Gao shook his head, muttering what was likely one of the few English words he knew in reply.
"No, no, no."
He looked to Turner and explained.
"He says they woke up less than a year ago," said Turner. "Their pods failed almost all at once. There were no rations, and everything else that was supposed to be with them was either destroyed or was never put there in the first place. Packs of seeds were filled with dirt and pebbles, things like that. The healthy ones just happened to find stray rations or grew adept at catching food. It was pretty much a free-for-all."
"Sounds like RUPAC," Bosa muttered.
But what Turner had just said was not what Reach had heard Gao say. Well, not precisely, anyway. Reach understood more than he once would have, thanks to whatever Alexa and Roman did. But he was having trouble keeping up, missing entire sections of conversation. Still, he was fairly certain that what Gao had said was that the new ones were from somewhere else. Another ship, maybe, where they had rations, or a better way to survive. Maybe Turner's grasp of the language was less than it could be. Or maybe it was Reach's grasp that was lacking. After all, he'd never studied it, and only comprehended it because of Alexa's enhancements.
"Did your men attack our base?" Sherman asked.
"Yes, he says the officers required it of them.
Many died. Now no officers are left.
But you attacked our column.
He says yes, they made us do it.
Who?
Turner frowned.
He's saying... I'm not sure what he means. Sorry.
But to Reach, the man's answer seemed clear. It was the other Rupak. He looked to Bosa, but held his peace, opting to just listen.
We want to make peace with the Rupak survivors, Sherman said.
Gao's face lit up at this news. He nodded eagerly and said that the survivors would gladly make peace. With the officers gone, they had freely been speaking treason. Better to dine with Americans than starve for Rupak, was Reach's understanding of the man's phrase.
Can you lead us to your crash site? Sherman asked. How far is it?
He says he will, Turner said. Says it's about 50 clicks south of our location.
Quite a walk, Bosa said. Reach grunted in agreement. It was a way off, but at least it was in the opposite direction of the healthy Rupak soldiers he'd encountered twice now.
Captain, he said, I need to be on this mission.
To negotiate terms?
Yes, sir, Reach said.
But in truth, that was only a secondary thought in his mind. The primary question that ate at him all of a sudden was one of Alexa's. What if